Welcome to the Chilean Sea Blob Podcast. In each episode, I'll share a previously published short fiction written by me, Theodore Carter. The stories will slither in and out of genre distinctions, but will consistently stay weird. Now, let's get started with today's story. The Canary in the Coal Mine. Tradition seeped from every corner of our home, hid beneath the old newspapers on the floor, and hung like a haze in the air. Before reaching working age, I'd lost my father and two brothers to the mines. Mother wore her widowhood and the death of her children like a badge of honor. In her mind, they died serving a higher purpose. Blue-collar aristocracy. "You've got a lot to be proud of, Cecil," she'd said. "Your family has saved many miners." Mother replaced dead loved ones with stories of their heroics. Great-grandfather died just moments before the explosion of 22. Grandfather collapsed of carbon inhalation in the bowels of West Virginia's deepest mine. His death led to the evacuation of 30 workers. Mother assumed I'd work the mines too. In my family, it takes dying to accomplish anything. When Mr. Jones placed his extended finger in front of my perch, signaling a first-time request for service, I thought of how I'd witnessed my father and my brothers receiving the same invitation. I moved only with the urging of my family. My sister and uncles sung words of encouragement. Mother chimed in, her voice wavering, on the verge of proud tears. "Cecil, it's your time, honey," she said. "Go with Mr. Jones." The force of history pushed me onto his pale finger. "Your turn to work the mines today, little one," said Mr. Jones as he latched the cage door. Without a choice, I'd become a coal mine canary. A miner others called Smitty carried my small cage. My perch swayed with his stride as we proceeded among the miners and donkeys. Tools clanked and jangled on belt loops and in wagons. Everything was the same coal-colored hue. I pictured my yellow coat shining like a beacon, a flash of color against a humdrum backdrop. Listening to the gab of the miners and the rhythmic clop of the donkey's hooves, I felt, for the first time, a touch of pride. I sang. My own melody mixed well with the sounds of our trudging brigade. As we walked, I thought maybe following in the footsteps of my father held some merit. I thrust my chest out, pushed my beak high, and sang louder. When we left the sun, everything changed. I stopped singing. The miners hardly talked. The tunnel narrowed and the mountains squeezed us, choking the light and air. Flickering lanterns showed hard rock. I forgot about pride and hope for resilience, for perseverance. I'd entered the grave of my ancestors. We continued downward and the temperature dropped. In the darkness, I saw clearly the idiocy of my heritage. Those that had come before had failed to make another choice. Like me, they'd walk like lemmings onto Mr. Jones' inviting finger. After what must have been a half-mile descent, Smitty placed my cage on the ground. He bent down and looked closely at me through the bars. "You take care of us here?" Smitty's voice was austere. I wanted to say something profound about the commonality of our fear. I only chirped, a strained exclamation denoting nothing in particular. The miners' broad, sweaty backs moved rhythmically as they swung their picks at the coal face. Steel clanked with each strike, and the walls resonated, threatening collapse. Rock fell away, and new crevices appeared. The scene flickered beneath the lantern's jumping light. It seemed as if the men were beating a living creature, and I waited for the retaliatory strike. A seepage of deadly gas or a rumbling of falling rock. I imagined gas had already leaked. With every breath, I tasted the air. Would I be able to tell if I was dying or would death come too fast? My anxiety grew. The miners had their battle with the rock and fatigue, tasks to take their minds off imminent death. I had no such distractions. The walls seemed to close in on me. The ringing of the metal tools became deafening, and the aura of death grew more specific and immediate. I felt lightheaded and nauseous. My breathing quickened. I had to leave. I couldn't wait until the end of our shift. They turned toward me every now and again, just often enough to make sure I was alive. I held some hope that my expression of horror would somehow transcend the boundaries of our species, that they would take one look at me, sweep me up, and carry me out of the mountain. But each time they glanced in my direction, they turned away without noticing my terror. There's only one way to leave the mine before the end of the shift. I closed my eyes, relaxed my clasp on the perch, and allowed my body to crash to the cage's bottom. Obligation to duty and my commitment to the miners tumbled with me to the cold iron surface. I lay motionless. Moments later, I heard Smitty. "Fellas, the bird is down." Smitty lifted my cage and soon I swayed again with the scurrying steps of his retreat. I remained still, my eyes closed, and listened to the miner's boots on the tunnel floor and to the jingling of the tools and buckets being lugged up. Their hysteria was my euphoria. I'd altered my destiny. Soon, I felt the warmth of the sun, recognized the brightness through my closed eyes. I knew we were safe. I'd survived. I lay still, contemplating the most delicate and tactful way to come back to life. Around me, I could hear a lot of men, one being Mr. Jones, and they all talked about my death. "There's something nasty down there for sure," said Mr. Jones. I slowly opened my eyes, but remained motionless. My cage, still held by Smitty, was at thigh height of about a dozen men. Nothing else to do, I raised to my feet. I heard Smitty's voice booming from above the cage. "Jones, Mr. Jones," he said, "that damn bird is alive." My cowardice on display, the miners turned toward me. For a brief moment, I wished I were still down below. Mr. Jones bent down to look at me. "I'll be damned, Smitty. Maybe your bird here was just napping. The mine must be all right." Dozens of dirty faces stared into my cage. "This one's a faulty alarm," Mr. Jones said to the group. The miners smiled, joked with one another, and retreated to the mine. Mr. Jones grabbed my cage and lifted me to eye level. He breathed audibly. He smelled of coffee. "You cost me a fair bit of money today, bird," he said. I didn't care about Mr. Jones's money. I thought of him now as the ringmaster of my family's daily game of Russian roulette. My cage swung with the cadence of his gait as we headed toward his office. Though no one came out and said it, my fainting spell disgraced the others. I wanted to explain. I wanted to shout, "Don't you see? We have to change. We have to turn away." But they'd never understand. Any attempt at dialogue would only force them to express their resentment. To make things worse, everyone who came into the office wanted to talk about the incident. Over the next week, I watched men laughing and teasing Mr. Jones, sometimes pointing over at our cage and calling us yellow-bellied or bird-brained. Mr. Jones always ended the ribbing the same way. "Damnedest thing, damnedest thing." I'd stand at the bottom of the cage, look out the office window, and try to ignore my mother's hard looks. Now when Mr. Jones came to pick one of us in the morning, he never chose me. "Not the broken one," he'd say while reaching in with his hairy hand. His utterance brought scornful looks, yet I couldn't help but feel relieved. At the same time, taking myself out of circulation increased the risk for the rest of the family. Uncle John and my sister Jane were picked more often. One day, around mid-afternoon, we saw the foreboding horse-drawn wagon move past the office window. Mr. Jones used the Black Maria to carry mangled bodies out of the mountain and back to unsuspecting wives. We canaries feared the sight of the Black Maria as much as the families of the mine workers. More often than not, dead miners meant one of our own had fallen. That evening, when the foreman returned to the office, he carried with him an empty cage. Uncle John was gone. My mother broke into a shaky dirge, a slow staccato of notes that Mr. Jones mistook for hunger. He walked over, deposited a scoop of seed, and said, "Sorry, little ones, I almost forgot. It's been a long day." Seeing that pale hand reach again toward our cage reminded me of our tortured existence. Mr. Jones was the most immovable tradition, keeping us alive so that we could constantly and systematically die. Closing the cage door, Mr. Jones retreated to his desk and began shuffling through papers, writing and writing in the customary manner that followed any appearance of the Black Maria. As the sky darkened, Mr. Jones lit a lantern on his desk. Mother continued to sing longer than usual, and I wondered if her melancholy notes were meant for me. I fluffed my feathers, creating a shield against my guilt. John was destined to die from the day of his birth. I tried hard to believe it was his fault for not fighting to change our circumstances, but that kind of explanation was abstract. The easier course of logic was that John's death could have been my own. If it weren't for my own cowardice, John would be here with the family instead of me. With a particularly bad accident such as this, it was Mr. Jones's practice to interview all who might have borne witness to the events. In this case, the most telling testimony came the day after Uncle John's death from a younger miner by the name of Perry. Mr. Jones walked into his office, followed by Perry, who entered with his head low, holding his hat in his hand. Jones sat behind his desk. I remained at the bottom of the cage, trying as best I could to appear indifferent. "Cigarette, Mr. Perry?" said Jones, extending the carved box. "No, thank you, sir." Jones took a pen out of his desk drawer and began to speak while writing on a clean sheet of paper. "Now, Perry, I just want you to tell me what happened, what you saw down there. You're not in any trouble here. I just got to turn in my paperwork for the state is all." Perry looked to his lap and the twisted cap in his hands. "I didn't see everything, sir," he said, "just before it happened." "Well, tell me what you know, Perry," said Jones. He hadn't lifted his eyes from his notes. "Well, me and Smith, Payne, Clark, and Jenkins, we were working in the western quadrant when Smitty saw his canary had gone and dropped over. Me and Payne, we said we were getting out of there before we dropped too, but Smitty and the rest of them didn't want to go. Smitty said a couple of weeks ago his bird fell off its perch for no reason at all and made him look real stupid, so he said he was going to wait a bit and see if his bird woke up." Jones leaned over his paper and looked at Perry. "Go on, what happened next?" "Well, Smitty started shaking the cage a bit, started talking to the bird. Me and Jenkins said we were getting out of there. Smitty said he'd be up soon, but me and Jenkins didn't wait. We got on up." "Smitty, Clark, and Payne stayed?" "When we got to the mouth, we were just sitting there gabbing, joking about Smitty talking to his bird. We figured the rest of them would be up any minute, so we didn't worry." "But they never came back up, is that right?" "Right, sir. They must have been waiting too long, thinking the bird was just faking. It must have been some of that bad air down there." "Thank you, Perry. That'll be all," said Jones, shifting his eyes back to his desk. Perry rose from his chair and left. Mother started with that slow dirge again and continued with it for weeks. She didn't sing in mourning, but in shame. The story of my uncle's death could never be retold of one of heroism. It could only be repeated in conjunction with the tale of my folly. My mother's feathers began to fall out, littering the cage floor. No one sang stories about our forefathers. My silence and attempts at seclusion didn't help anyone forget what had happened. Our home smelled of guilt, shame, and anger. No one talked about it, but the tension was palpable. My sister started to refuse work, which meant more trips to the mine for my aunt. My family wanted me to admit my wrongdoing so they could forgive me. They'd never understand that my refusal of duty was intended as a step towards something else. Recognizing an impasse, I knew it was time for me to leave. The cage and confines of Mr. Jones's office weren't much of an impediment. Wood and iron are easy enough to escape with the right timing, planning, and diligence. The greater obstacles are those you cannot see, perhaps not even define. As I flew through the cage door and past Mr. Jones, I felt the weight of my mother's stories on my wings. When I darted over the desk, the smell of coal made me weak. Seeing the crack in the screen door, the small flap where the wire mesh had come loose, I felt the tug of a repressed sense of loyalty. Still, I made it through the doorway. I followed the coal road away from the mine, a direction we canaries never traveled. I flew past what I assumed to be the miners' dingy houses. While flying away from the mine's poison and the infectious complacency of my family, I knew the broad promise of the outside world could prove just as toxic. I continued, ready to start my own legacy, my own traditions, but deep down I knew I was simply fleeing the past. As I distanced myself, excitement gave way to fatigue. I flew slowly. My fierce defiance transformed into a sense of aimlessness. I wondered if there was any system to warn the coal mine canary of what might happen next.
Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed today's story. If you did, please leave a rating and a review. Also, please tell a friend directly. Personal recommendations help a lot. My main goal with this podcast is to grow an audience for future work, and it'd be great to connect with more odd people who like strange art. I'd love to connect on social media. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at TheodoreCarter2 or on Facebook with the handle at ChileanSeaBlog. This story and other stories in this podcast are part of my book, The Life Story of a Chilean Sea Blob and Other Matters of Importance. The book is available wherever books are sold online, and you can find links to all of my books on my website, TheodoreCarter.com. You can also find other things there, like videos of me making a giant cement eyeball or turning traffic boxes into robots. Music from this podcast comes from TMI Management. TMIMGMT.com. Thanks again for being here, and I hope you come again.